The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 129.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I've really looked forward to talking to. Everyone on Twitter says, hey, you got to interview this guy. You got to interview this guy. So we've got him today on the Rebel Capitalist Show. Totally stoked. Stephen Van Meter, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
George, thank you for having me on your show.
Okay, now you are a macro money manager, and I think you're in California, but for those of my viewers or listeners who don't fully know your backstory and how you got to where you are today, where everyone's suggesting you on FinTwit and you got your YouTube channel, can you just kind of get us up to speed there?
Sure. Years ago, as my business was growing, I realized that communication with your clients is absolutely critical. The more often you can communicate and the better you can communicate with them, the more they will understand what you're doing and why you're doing it. And when you run macro funds, you really need to communicate on a regular basis. And so I started writing like many financial advisors do, and that turned from quarterly to monthly to weekly. And I realized that there was still something missing. So I started doing videos. And those videos were originally private, you know, on a private server with a private link. And for whatever reason, one day, my compliance officer said, hey, if you want to put it on YouTube, go for it. So I've started putting it on YouTube, and I wasn't allowed to post on Twitter until recently. Brent Johnson, who I believe has been on your show.
Oh, yeah. Good buddies with Brent. Brent's fantastic. Yeah.
And he invited me onto Real Vision and went on to Twitter with that. And next thing you know, I went from a person with no followers to a couple thousand, and I'd never made a post. So my compliance officer was forced into capitulating and saying, okay, I'll compliance that. Good, have fun.
that's hilarious. Yeah, you know, that reminds me of my Instagram account. I'm never on Instagram. And someone told me the other day, I've got like 2,000 followers or something like that on Instagram. I'm like, how? I don't even know. But anyway, okay. So so what's going on with your YouTube channel? What types of things do you discuss right now?
We mainly just talk about macro, what's going on with monetary policies, everything surrounding the Fed. We talk about the bond market. We do talk about the equity market, but I don't think people really appreciate how important the bond market is into understanding all the moving parts of macro and the investing world. So we talk a lot about that and kind of just whatever is on my mind in terms of, you know, in the investing world.
Yeah. So let's dive into that. Let's go into the bond market. What are your views on the bond market right now? What is it telling us? And how do you filter out all the noise from the Fed's QE buying bonds and any type of artificial demand that might be there?
Right. Well, up until, you know, this month, I still am very bullish on bonds, although it's funny that on a daily basis, when bonds go down, people comment and say how wrong I am. But, you know, when you have a macro view, you don't worry about the short term fluctuations. Right. Until the data really changes underneath, that it's just noise. But my view is interest rates are across the curve going to go either negative or on the long end close to or hit 0%. And I believe that will likely happen this year.
Okay. So can you outline that through the framework of the Fisher equation? Because I just did a video on that with Lacey Hunt. And I think the Fisher equation, for people who don't know, it's very straightforward. It's just that nominal rates minus the rate of inflation equals real rates. But where that really comes into play is if to Dr. Lacey Hunt's point, this isn't mine, I just explained it on a video. If the Fed pegs rates at zero, let's say, and you have deflation, so you have negative inflation, let's say at negative two, then the further negative deflation goes or inflation, the higher the positive rates are for the real economy. And if you have positive real rates going up and up and up, that means less loans or fewer loans out there because people can't afford to take those loans to buy the cars, to buy the houses, to start the businesses. And therefore, you just have this kind of self-fulfilling, or maybe a positive feedback loop just all the way down. And I think if more people understood or thought through the Fisher equation from that context, I think it would make a lot more sense. So are you seeing things the same way as Dr. Lacey Hunt?
Very similar. I'm a huge fan of his research. In my opinion, he is one of, if not the smartest man in the room when it comes to the bond market. And you know what I view is, and this is really a very minority view right now, but I am bullish on the dollar. And when you look at the Fisher equation, the big key is if you see a dollar rally, it's going to drive the CPI negative. And when you do the math into real yields, you can get real yields turning positive, which is massively dollar bullish. Right. And that will tighten financial conditions. And as you mentioned, put people right out of being able to get the loans that they need to get.
Yeah, or at least the loans they need to continue expanding the money supply and having more money chasing fewer goods and services in the real economy.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you.
Okay, so let's unpack that a little bit further. So when you're talking about your dollar bullish, that can mean so many different things. So are we dollar bullish against U.S. asset prices? Are we dollar bullish on the DXY? When you're looking at a basket of currencies, it's mostly the euro. Are we dollar bullish when we're looking at our grocery bill? Where are we dollar bullish?
Yeah, great question. I'm dollar bullish on the DXY. And a lot of people ask me, why, Steve, do you focus on the DXY? Well, I don't have a Bloomberg terminal, and I assume that a lot of other people don't. But one of the great things about DXY is you can get it anywhere, and you can get it on the Federal Reserve FRED database where you can chart against other things. So it's very accessible. Okay. And I'm bullish on that simply because quantitative easing, despite what most people claim, actually removes liquidity and is bullish for the dollar.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go through that. If you can explain, because I think most people will hear that and they'll be like, what is this guy talking about? How can that even be kind of possible? So can you unpack that for us or explain your rationale?
Sure. A lot of people don't like that mainly because Fed Chair Powell himself has said that injects liquidity. Unfortunately, he is completely wrong about that. And I know he realizes that. But unfortunately, George, as you know, monetary policy is a lot of psychology.
Yeah.
What most people don't understand about quantitative easing is nothing more than a swap in reserves. So a commercial bank is holding treasury securities, bills, notes, and bonds. And the average maturity is probably a little less than 7 years on those. And what the Fed comes in and does is says, look, we're going to buy this. And there's a schedule that they're running, and they run a 9-day schedule that they rotate every month, and they're buying $80 billion worth of treasuries. Now, because the Federal Reserve Act prohibits the Fed from printing money, they can't actually pay the banks directly for those treasury securities, which is what everyone believes is happening. Instead, what happens is the Fed takes those treasury securities, removes them from the system, takes the cash that they create an accounting entry with, and they deposit it in an account at a Federal Reserve member bank in the name of the bank.
Right.
However, the bank cannot actually withdraw that money. So the bank can count it as a reserve asset to their total reserves, but they cannot withdraw the money. So the bank actually never receives the money and cannot put it back into the economy. So therefore, when the Fed does quantitative easing, they're actually removing dollars from the system.
Yeah, so just to put it in layman terms, I think that we could all understand what the Fed is doing is they're taking away cash, let's call it, and they're giving the bank Dave and Buster tokens. They're saying
just a collateral account.
We'll give you a dollar worth of Dave and Buster tokens, but you can only spend these Dave and Buster tokens at Dave and Buster's.
Well, it's even worse. They can't spend them. So let's say that I borrowed your car and you said, Steve, I've kind of seen your driving record and I got a really nice car and I want to make sure that, you know, if something goes wrong, that I get my money. And so I take a pile of money and we give it to a mutual third party. And I go driving off down the street and you go over to that person and say, I'd like that money, and say, well, it's not yours, George. It's not yours. Now, if the car doesn't come back or something's wrong, then yeah, the contract says we can give you the money. But until then, you can look at it, you can see it, but you can't actually touch it. It is not yours.
Right.
And that's what people don't understand about quantitative easing. They need to view it as a collateral account where the banks actually don't have the money.
Right. So that's if they're buying assets that are currently on the bank's balance sheet. So let's take it a step further and let's think through. So the bank goes to the primary dealer bank, they go to the auction and they take their cash and they say, okay, we're going to buy XYZ amount of treasuries. And then we're just going to flip that to the Fed. So again, it's this scenario where and I'm using deficit spending for a reason. So the cash in the system is going down, we'll call it broad money, is going down in order to buy those treasuries. And it's not going back up because the Fed isn't replacing broad money, they're just increasing base money. But then that money, let's call it, goes into the TGA, which is at the Fed, excuse me. Then the Treasury spends the money back out into the economy. So now the money's at least back there, but it's not a net positive. It's just a net wash.
The money doesn't go to the TGA. It never gets there. The TGA money comes when the U.S. Treasury borrows. That has nothing to do with the Fed. It's okay. two separate things going on.
Well, the TGA accounts at the Fed.
TGA accounts at the Treasury. Well, it may be held at the Fed, but it's the Treasury's checking account. Quantitative easing doesn't put any money in the TGA account.
Well, if the primary dealer banks are buying the treasuries at auction, that money has to go into the TGA.
So the primary dealers buy it at auction, and even though the dealers are owned by the commercial banks, which is where there's some fuzzy stuff here. Yes, that goes to the TGA. The primary dealers then flip it to the commercial banks, who then take their cash out of reserves and pay for the treasury securities, and now they have a treasury security in reserve that goes to the Fed. So the quantitative easing isn't a direct path there.
Right.
It was a direct path that would be money printing. And I just want to be clear for your listeners that, the money is getting there, but it's not a direct money printing path.
Right. So, but then when it's in the treasury, the money's basically gone from a bank for the treasuries to the treasury's account. And then the treasury will spend it back into the economy. So it's not decreasing. When they spend it, initially it definitely decreases broad money. If you're calculating broad money and that it's cash on the asset side of the bank's balance sheet.
Right.
But then once the treasury spends that money that they received from the auction back into the economy, then theoretically, all things being equal, then the broad money would go back up to the level it was before. Am I seeing that correctly?
Well, the problem is the Fed doesn't actually pay the banks for the QE. So the banks have to get cash to buy the next round from their own business services. So from lending and interest on the loans, they're not getting it back from the Fed. That's the critical point.
Right, but my point is it's going from the asset side of, let's call it the cash, is going from the asset side of the bank's balance sheet, and then it's going to the treasury, then back out into the economy, becoming another liability, a deposit liability for the commercial banking system that's backed up, I would assume by reserves, but it's going from the asset side of the bank's balance sheet to the asset side of a, let's say, a person's balance sheet who gets a stimulus check.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is flowing, but there is a point where there, because the Fed can only create base money, as you mentioned, that they are pulling that liquidity out of the economy. Now they're, of course, in the system, are we hoping that the TGA money that gets spent as stimulus goes back out and is borrowed and new money is created? Of course, we don't know exactly how that's going to play out. I mean, it's going to vary depending on the consumer. But while there is a flow, there is a little bit of a break in there that people perceive as money printing, but it is not money printing.
Yeah, most people, they look at the Fed taking their balance sheet to $7 trillion or whatever and just call that money printing. And I mean, it's tough because I use those terms as well. And I find myself, even when I'm doing a whiteboard video saying, oh, the Fed's printing all this money. And I mean, they're printing bank reserves. It's almost like it's too cumbersome to say every time the Fed is quote unquote printing money. Well, I'm talking about money printing, but here's really what they're doing, and then go into an hour explanation. And that's what I think makes it confusing for just normal people out there, even for people like me that really geek out on this stuff. It makes it extremely confusing. And I don't know, maybe that's the intention or or maybe that's just the way the system is set up. But let's go down a different path here. I always try to use thought experiments, and I totally see what's going on with you know, what you're talking about, and Brent talks about all the time, and Dr. Lacey Hunt, with if you don't have the if there's not appetite for the commercial banking system to create more loans into the real economy. And also, people don't look at the demand side of the equation. You know, they just assume that there's always demand. Now, I talked to my buddy Hugh Hendry the other day at lunch about this, actually. And I said, yeah, but you got to look at the demand side of the equation. If people's incomes don't justify more lending, then they're not going to go out to the bank and just take on more loans just because. And he actually believes that they will if the banks have enough pressure on them to lend. And he used the example of Japan in the late 1980s, and where the, you know, the government almost put a gun to their head and said, listen, you create a loan or you lose your job, period. And so he's saying, you know, we're not to that point, but regardless, people, I think, get fixated on the banks lending money. But if they don't have anyone to lend to, then that M2 money supply or broad money isn't going to increase. And I think that's where people really need to focus their money printing thoughts, is on the commercial banking system, and maybe not so much on just the base money and the Fed's balance sheet. So my point is, the next step here is I want to try to figure out how the Fed could possibly circumnavigate the commercial banking system in the future. Obviously not the way it's set up now, but is there a way? And what I'm thinking of right off the top of my head, Steve, is if you read the paper from the BOE, from the Bank of England, back in 2014, that money creation paper, I forgot what it's called, they outline quantitative easing. And they have a little diagram as far as the central bank's balance sheet, and they use a pension fund in this case, their balance sheet, and then the balance sheet of the commercial banking system that's in between. And their argument is that when the Bank of England is buying assets, almost inadvertent, I mean, it's not direct, but there's the commercial bank in the middle, that they're actually increasing base money and broad money. And so, and I mean, they just outline it right there. So I was thinking about, number one, if they're doing quantitative easing differently than we're doing it here in the United States, or I know Professor Werner has suggested that Japan did it much different than not only the ECB, but the Fed as well. And so kind of going over that, and then going over kind of what could happen in the future for the Fed to get around that system of the commercial banking system being so in control of broad money.
Yeah, those are great questions, because I think one of the mistakes people make is they look at the M2 and then they look at the monetary base and they think the same thing is happening. And while it appears that way, it certainly is not. Now, I'm not familiar with the BOE paper, but Professor Werner is correct. The monetary system in Japan and England and the U.S., while similar in many aspects, the Fed has far more restrictive rules on it than any other central bank. And I have thought about, okay, how do we get, you know, really high rates of inflation or direct money printing? And there's really only two avenues that I see happening, at least, and I'm not suggesting that they could happen. I'm just saying that if they did, right. And one would be there have to be parts of the Federal Reserve Act repealed. Okay. Another option would be if Congress went in and said, hey, Fed, we're going to take an eraser to your balance sheet. Now, at that point, that cash collateral that's sitting in those accounts would have to go back to the banks, because, again, Fed can't print money, but that money has to flow back. Now, if a whole wad of trillions of dollars of cash hit the commercial banking system overnight, it'd be massively inflationary.
Okay, so we're talking about basically making these bank reserves into legal tender, as Dr. Hunt would say, or in other words, we're talking about taking all these Dave and Buster tokens and giving the banks cash for the Dave and Buster tokens they have.
Correct. Yeah. If Congress did that, that would be very inflationary. No question about it.
Yeah, because then, and the reason it's inflationary is because now you're having a significant increase in the amount of currency units that are actually circulating in the real economy that are chasing a certain amount of goods and services, if not a decreasing amount of goods and services as a result of supply constrictions due to everything that's going on with the virus right now.
Right. Yeah. And from the bank's perspective, you know, all of a sudden now you're the recipient of untold trillions of cash as a system, and you don't want it. You want to get it out of your door as fast as possible because you know it's going to be inflationary and it's going to lose value. So what's the best thing I can do is hopefully find you and other people like you to go out and borrow something so I can just get this out of there. That would be a big motivation for the banks to decrease lending standards and just open the floodgates to get that money out.
What would happen to interest rates? Because if I'm a bank and I'm giving out let's just say that they kept a 30-year loan on their books, which they most likely don't, but let's just say that they did, even a 10-year, right. You know, I'm thinking, okay, well, and now we go back to the Fisher equation, and that when the Fisher equation is applied to the real economy, we've got to add a risk premium. So if you're a bank saying, okay, I'm going to give $1 million loan, but I see all this inflation coming down the pipeline because the Congress just changed Dave and Buster tokens into actual dollar bills. Yeah, I'll give you this mortgage, but if you're not paying me back, or if you're paying me back over the next 20 or 30 years, listen, you're going to have to pay a 10, 12% interest rate, just like we'd see in a country like Colombia. That's what the mortgage rates are there, because the banks expect for them to be paid back with devalued currency units. So what would go on there with interest rates and mortgage rates?
Yeah, there's no doubt that interest rates would skyrocket. It would probably look like, you know, the late 70s, early 80s. Yeah. And I have this weird view that the monetary system is self-regulating. And I don't know if that's a very popular or common view, but the way I look at it is when money enters a system, that interest rates are in a debt-based system, interest rates regulate the money supplies. Now, when we were on the gold standard, gold regulated it because you had to have so much gold for every unit of currency you printed. Right. But when we went off the gold standard, all of a sudden interest rates started getting out of control and no one understood why. Well, the answer is really simple. The system was just growing into this new pair of pants that its parents bought that didn't fit, and it had to expand. And then once equilibrium was reached, then everything started to settle down. So there's no doubt in my mind that interest rates would rapidly rise if, you know, that money became legal tender.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
So if we follow, let's back up here a little bit. If we follow this deflationary path, and that the banks don't want to lend, therefore, and there's no demand out there, therefore we have fewer and fewer loans being generated. Therefore, on net balance, the money supply is quite literally shrinking. As far as and see, a lot of people are going to say, well. And I would even say, well, you got to look at M2 and it's going parabolic. So how can we worry about the growth of the money supply when M2 is at a hockey stick right now? But I know that my good buddy Jeff Snyder would chime in and he'd say, George, you can't look at M2. That isn't all of the money supply right there. And that makes it even more confusing. But so maybe we can touch on why M2 is kind of a tough measurement to look at. And then once we get done with that, then we can outline maybe where this deflationary path takes us and kind of what the end game is.
Sure, that'd be great. So when I look at the M2, and a lot of people just stop at that hockey puck chart. And one thing that I try to encourage people to do, and I do on my show, and I know you do too, George, is you got to dig under that a little bit. You got to pop the hood and see what's really going on. And when you look at the key parts of the M2, you find that it's broken down into three categories. You have savings, checkings, and what's institutional money fund. Now, if people don't know what that is, they'll be surprised. They know what it is. If you have a brokerage investment account, a 401k, or any type of retirement account, the cash in that account, now whether you have any or not, that's what's referred to as institutional money funds. Okay. And the biggest component of the M2 is savings. So why did we see this thing shoot up? Well, it was pretty obvious. We had the economy shut down due to the pandemic. People lost their jobs, but the government said, hey, don't worry about it. We're going to pay you, or many of you, over half of you, more money than you made to stay home. Right. And since everything's closed, you can't spend it. And while we're at it, you don't have to pay on your loans either. We're going to go to the banks and tell them to defer all of your money, all your payments. So people had extra money that they couldn't spend. Now, some people did spend it. We saw that Amazon was a huge recipient. We saw people open brokerage accounts and invest in the market. And where did the rest go? It went into savings. So the M2 shot up. But likely the growth rate of the M2 is probably going to go negative because at some point, now, for example, we're seeing that the extra stimulus is gone. So people are now making less than they were employed. And at some point starting next month, and this isn't true for government backed loans, but starting next month, people are going to have to start making payments on their loans. And some of these loans are going to have a lump sum 6 months come in. So they're going to have 6 months to catch up plus the 7th month payment. Well, there's a reason that savings is there and it's probably not going to last.
Right. So, and then going back to your point with M2, we saw a huge decrease in velocity, which was already trending down, and that would explain that decrease.
Well, velocity has another factor that I don't know that too many people have looked at, and it's really complex. And I'm not going to suggest that I know the mechanics of the M2, but I'm a simple guy, and I like to make simple relationships that a lot of people can understand. Yeah. And the way I view velocity of money is tied to government debt, because the larger their government gets and the more money they need, they crowd out private industry. And I know you as a businessman, George, you felt the effect, I feel the effect, our listeners feel the effect of the government, because they have such a huge appetite for dollars that they crowd out everybody else. So if you take a chart of the velocity of the M2, and you can do this on the FRED database, and you add total government debt, they'll run opposite directions, and then invert government debt, and you'll find out that excessive government borrowing leads to lower velocity of money.
You know, that makes a lot of sense, because I'm just thinking this through out loud as we talk, and I remember that whiteboard video I did. I was talking, and this is Dr. Lacey Hunt's idea, not mine. But he was talking about it's not just about the debt. That's why, as an example, if we had a debt jubilee where we had all the treasuries go onto the Fed's balance sheet, and then they just click a button and all of a sudden it just takes the scoreboard from 100 down to zero, we just start all over again. You still have the government at 50% of the economy, if not more. You know, government spending is now probably over 50% of GDP. So even if you took the debt levels down to zero, it doesn't get rid of the fact that the government is still this huge part of the economy. And so where I'm going with this is, as an entrepreneur, the more money the government spends, the more regulations you're going to have, the harder it's going to be to do business, most likely. Therefore, the fewer loans that you're taking out as an entrepreneur, the fewer people that you're hiring, and you've got the government taking a bigger piece of that pie, which would lead to decrease velocity. So, but now what I'm thinking through, Steve, is how would that affect the supply of goods and services, and how do we juxtapose that against the decrease in velocity. So the decrease in velocity is deflationary. But if we have fewer goods and services that are being produced by the private sector, then that could be inflationary as well. So how do we balance that? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, it still ends up being deflationary. And I think it's worth exploring why government debt crowds out the private economy. Because in a debt-based economy, as you know, George, there's never enough money to pay on all the debts. That's why we all go to work. Effectively, what people don't realize is that you and I and everyone else, every day, we all need dollars. And there's a limited supply, and we compete for them against each other. There are some people that are massive winners, they're billionaires, and there are other people that are homeless, and they're losers. So we compete, but we're also competing against the federal government. Because when you and I go out and borrow money, we create money when we go to a bank. That the federal government doesn't borrow from a bank. They have to borrow from the existing pool of dollars. So we are actually competing with them. So as they borrow more and more money, it actually ends up being deflationary because it puts people out of work, it closes businesses down. And while there is, as you mentioned, a potential shortage in goods and services, there's also a shortage in demand because people have less money.
Hmm. Okay, well, that's very interesting. I need to think through that and do a whiteboard video on that in and of itself. That's very good. But let's go back to this path of deflation. If you're seeing it correctly, if Dr. Lacey Hunt, Brent, and our good buddies, where does this take us? Like where do we go? I know you believe we're going to negative interest rates, but at some point we can't, or can we? I mean, could we go negative 10, negative 20? I mean, I'm just trying to use extreme thought experiments to try to come to kind of the probabilities of where we go if we're headed down this path.
Yeah, that's great. I do the same thing. When I'm having trouble with some idea and people hear me say, well, minus 10%, like what? You think that? I'm like, no, I just need an exaggerated number to work with.
Yeah, I do that all the time.
You know, I think the Treasury yield curve is going to, you know, dip negative. I don't think the first round when we have this deflationary shock, it's going to drop 5-6% negative. And then what's going to happen is you're going to see a sharp rise in inflation. This is going to look just like what happened after interest rates crashed in late 2008. What you saw was a smart money who was sitting on a massive pile of bonds took advantage of low interest rates and sold it as people who were sitting in equities realized they didn't have any portfolio insurance and oddly enough will be buying bonds at zero or negative interest rates to hedge their losses. Now from there, barring any changes in the monetary system, which I don't believe will happen just yet. And people say, well, why not? Won't that work? I said, look, in order for Congress to want to change things and the Fed to recommend them, they got to be really bad. I mean, really bad. So we'll have this boost of inflation. That's where I think you'll see things like precious metals and emerging market stocks or inflation sensitive assets spike back up. And then deflation will make its way back, and then you'll see, you know, deflation pulling back down on prices.
Okay, and so where does that take us, though? I mean, does that take us to the 1930s? And if it does, I mean, how do you get out of it? How do you get out of that deflationary spiral? Because going back to the Fisher equation, you got to at some point get ahead of the curve and drop rates so far negative that you get real rates negative to get the borrowing back up. But even if you get the borrowing back up, the damage has been done. It's not like you've got this robust economy. I mean, the zombie corporations in Japan still exist, regardless of what happens to the amount of debt. The government is still 50% of spending, regardless of what we do to debt. So it's not like just getting people to go out and borrow some money is going to fix everything. And we're just right back to the races or the end of the 1800s in the United States. You know, so I mean, where does it go? Does it look like a 1930s type of situation to where we just have to tighten our belts? We have to underconsume as much as we've overconsumed over the past, call it 3 or 4 decades. And we just have to reduce our standard of living to a level that most people don't want to accept. And that's really the only way out.
Yeah, I do agree with that. So let's say we didn't do anything. Let's just say we have this second round of deflation. we're now following the path of the second Great Depression. Now, what do we look like? Well, then the Fed just does this infinite QE and we become Japan. I mean, that's the do nothing, continue where we're headed. If we want to get out of this, and what, as you correctly mentioned, what they did following the Great Depression, and it was a very hard pill to swallow, but the government did something that no one wants to hear. They had to cut spending. They had to lay off people. They had to close departments. And effectively, they had to pay down the debt and return the economy to the people. And that did work. And of course, World War II was also a big boost. And sometimes, well, when there's enough people out of work and around the world, well, it's sad to say, but there is a war cycle and they tend to follow really bad economic times. That could happen. But the best way to get out of this is to shrink the size of the government and for everyone to accept that, right, our standard of living is going to go down for a while. But in order for it to go up long term, we need to restrain the size of our government.
Yeah, see, I think that's the best solution, but I don't think that will be politically palatable. I
don't think people want it. I don't think the average American wants that. I don't think they want to hear that, hey, you know what? Maybe you can't have that new foreign car. Or maybe you can't go on that fancy vacation or buy that bigger house. And reality is you need to eat home, you know, 5 days a week. And when you go out the other two times, you can't go to the expensive restaurant. I don't think they want to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it gets a lot worse than that. I mean, going back to the Japan analogy, but you know, this real estate prices in Japan went down from 1990 all the way to 2005, and they've barely come up since then. And you look at the Japanese market, it's nowhere near what it was back in 90 in nominal or real terms. And I just think about the United States, in my opinion, and I'd love to get your opinion on this as well, that the entire economy is really based on asset prices, and I would argue asset bubbles, and debt, and confidence. Mm-hmm. And I think Grohman talks about, he did some study where he was saying that a large portion of consumer spending is a result of the stock market going up, risk assets going up. So my point is, if you have the US stock market go down, let's say by 50 or 60% and stay there, mm-hmm. and you have home prices, which is the majority of most Americans' wealth, if those go back down to their 2012 levels, which I would argue is actually a healthy level, if you look at home prices going back to 1900 when you adjust for size and inflation, that's really our historic trend line is 2012. Yeah. But so anyway, the equity prices go down, people's 401k goes down by 60%, their house goes down by 50, 60% and stays there. I mean, what does that do to consumer spending? It's kind of a rhetorical question, but I think it's more than just people not being able to go to Olive Garden four times a week or go on that extra vacation to the Caribbean. It gets really ugly.
Yeah, it does. And you're spot on. Well, I do agree that asset prices are way overvalued. And I'm not familiar with Luke's comment on that. I will say that the Fed has figured this out decades ago. And even though the Fed can't pump stock prices, they can jawbone them higher, but they can't actually purchase them. There is a relationship between consumer spending and the stock price. And it's interesting that, and this, I'm not complimenting President Trump on this or any president. I just want to, it's just interesting to me from a macro investor that President Trump either got it when he went into office or someone whispered in his ear and said, hey, the higher you can get the stock market, there's a good chance consumer spending will go with it. And that is 100% correct. Mm-hmm. Now, if we do see a massive deflationary shock and housing prices and equity values crash and stay low, it's going to be a big challenge because where is most of our spending coming from by generation? It's the baby boomers. Right. They have their debt is reducing. They have the largest cash flow and they have the largest asset base. It's not Gen X, not my generation. The millennials, you know, they should be rooting for a stock market crash and real estate prices crash. Yeah. They've got it backwards.
You can finally buy a house.
You know, they want the economy to crash because they need to get their debt paid off. And unfortunately, they, of all generations, they entered the economy with the most debt. They need to get their debt paid down, buy real assets, buy homes, buy rental homes, buy stocks, and then hope they stay cheap. So they could just build up more and more and more for like 10 years and then watch them take off.
Yeah, right.
But you're right. The problem is if all this happens, that spending power from the boomers goes away. They start living like their parents did from the Great Depression. And, you know, the economy just stays in the weeds for a very long time until the debt gets paid down.
Yeah. So I think what most people or what most viewers and listeners, what's probably going through their mind right now is, okay, there's no way that we can have a stock market crash or housing prices. There's no way they can go down by 50% because the Fed will just come in and they'll buy stocks. I mean, look at this. They're buying junk debt. They're buying junk corporate debt. They're buying every single mortgage-backed security that the banking system can conjure up or that Fannie and Freddie can turn into a, I call them mortgage-backed sausages, you know, because that's kind of what they do. Yeah,
that's a good analogy. I never heard that.
But it'll all just go onto the Fed's balance sheet. So we've got nothing to worry about. At the end of the day, they'll just buy everything in sight. What's wrong or right about that argument?
Well, the law says they can buy U.S. Treasury, unlimited amount of U.S. Treasury securities and mortgage-backed sausages, if we will. now they are technically violating the Federal Reserve Act by buying the corporate bonds, and I don't think a lot of people understand why they're doing it. And I don't know that they really wanted to do it, but I think they were forced into doing it because when the pandemic hit, corporations realized the Fed wasn't really going to bail them out because they didn't really work in 2008-9. So what did they all run and do? They borrowed their short-term equity lines, or what the industry calls revolvers. So they just went out and grabbed 100% of their equity lines.
Right.
And they knew when they grabbed it that as things improved, they would refinance that debt with either stock issuance or bond issuance.
Okay, Steve, let me stop right there. So what? Just to put this in normal terms, guys, basically, let's say you've got a line of credit against the equity in your house for $100,000. So you see it hitting the fan, and you're like, listen, I'm gonna need some cash. So I'm gonna go to the bank really quick, and I'm gonna take out this line of, well, I've got the line of credit, but I'm gonna exercise it. I'm gonna take the $100,000 in cash and put it into my bank account. And then when things get better, I'll go ahead and sell my car and get the $100,000, assuming you got a pretty nice car. And then I'll just pay back the line of credit once I sell my car and things get a little bit better. That's pretty much what we're saying right here, right?
Exactly. And why would you do that? Because you had a feeling that the bank could close your equity line, right? Right. They can do that in an instant. I mean, if anyone's ever had one, even if you had the best credit back in 2008-9, you still got that letter. So the corporations knew it. They grabbed those equity lines, and most of that got refinanced or is being refinanced into the bond market. Well, the problem with the bond market is only so big. There's only so much corporate debt that people or investors want to stomach. Now, unlike treasuries, when the Fed buys them and they drive interest rates lower, when you get a flood of new issuance into the corporate bond market, it causes interest rates to go up. Well, guess what the Fed really does not want right now? A spike in corporate interest rates.
Yeah,
so what they're doing is they're trying to take that supply off the market a bit to buffer this new issuance. And then they had to go and buy junk bonds because they knew some company's debt was going to get rated down and go from investment grade to junk. Well, guess what? There's only so many people that want to buy junk bonds. And if you
and a lot fewer.
Right. You get a whole nother catastrophe. So the Fed is technically lending the U.S. taxpayers money to, so you and I, all of us are buying these bonds. The intention is they will get returned or sold back into the economy at some point. And if there's a profit, the Fed will return the profit to the U.S. Treasury. If there's a loss, the American taxpayer will make the Fed whole. But that is a gray area of what they're doing. They do not have the authority to purchase stocks. Doesn't mean they could not be granted that by Congress in the future. But as of right now, the view that they can purchase equities is not correct.
Yeah, I don't think here's my view personally. I think definitely according to the Federal Reserve Act, and I tried to read through it the other day. Obviously, it's not exactly exciting to read the Federal Reserve Act.
But it's bedtime reading if you can't sleep.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it was section 14, I believe, 14B or something like that. It says open market operations. Right. And it goes into what they can and can't buy. So, yeah, I mean, I think that if they're sticking to the Federal Reserve Act, that yes, that's the way it goes. I just don't see them sticking to it. I just see them ignoring it or just setting up some special purpose vehicle or doing whatever, just, you know, kind of a smoke and mirrors, because no one's, I mean, the economy is really tanking, let's say. And look at what happened in March. I mean, no one said, oh, Fed, you can't do that. That's the Federal Reserve Act. I'm going to sue you, or I'm going to do X, Y, or Z to make sure that you're abiding by the law. No one's doing that. They're just ignoring it. They're turning their head the other direction. And they're just saying, listen, it we're desperate times, you know, require desperate measures. And so I see them in the future ignoring the Federal Reserve Act more and more and more, because it's like, once you cross that line, then you see there's no pushback whatsoever. Well, then let me just push that line a little further. And that's why I'm not saying that this is a certainty. Obviously, it's just probabilities. And I'm just some crazy guy on YouTube. But I just see in the future the Fed being more and more receptive to ignoring the spirit of the Federal Reserve Act.
You know, George, it's possible. I don't think it'd be the first thing they do. And I kind of look back to the great financial crisis, and I think Bernanke, of all the Fed chairs, and then Yellen following, I mean, if there was someone in place that would do it, it would be them. I look at Powell and I say, here's a guy who does not have a PhD in economics. He doesn't come from academia. He didn't write some paper justifying the purchase of stocks. He's got a lot to risk by doing, you know, sticking his neck out.
Yeah.
The other factor I look at, and I think people need to appreciate, is the dollar is the world's reserve currency. If the Fed goes too far, and they can, and the rest of the world loses confidence in the Fed's ability to control the system, well, we don't, you know, I know a lot of people think, well, it'd be okay if the dollar loses its reserve status. Until it does, and you'll wish we didn't, because will things be okay, but our lifestyle won't be like they are now. So I think the Fed really understands that, and they're not going to go out and do something that would jeopardize, you know, the world's confidence in the dollar.
Yeah. How does that look? I mean, you're talking about how that gets ugly. And I would assume that's because that all these dollars that are outside the United States would come back home, because it's kind of like this hot potato that Doug Casey always talks about. And then you've got the euro dollar system. You've got all these things at play. But the bottom line is, there's, who knows? I mean, 20 trillion, quote unquote, dollars outside of the United States that isn't currently circulating. And if you're some rich person, let's say you have $1 million and you're in Colombia, and your expenses are denominated in pesos, let's say, and you have this $1 million in your checking account, and you see the DXY going from 100 to 90 to 80 to 70 to 60 to 50, you're like, holy cow, what's going on? I got to do something. Sell these dollars, or let me buy some sort of US dollar denominated asset in the United States, so I'm not losing purchasing power. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I think a lot of people view that it would just be some overnight thing, and that's not realistic. There would be a period of time, because someone else would have to step up and be the reserve. The challenge we would have is, right now we could print money to pay our own debt, so to speak. And again, I hate to use that term, but we could run unlimited deficits effectively because we're the reserve currency. What would happen is we wouldn't be able to do that anymore. So we would have to pay our own debt off, and then we would have an unknown period of austerity until the debt is paid down. Now, I don't think people outside the country would immediately dump their dollars, because they know that would get devalued even quicker, but they would be very motivated over time to get rid of those dollar assets for sure.
Yeah. And then going back to the bond market would ensure the austerity, because interest rates would be going Volcker, as was what they'd be doing.
and the federal government would be absolutely forced to cut its spending overnight. And Congress doesn't want that. I mean, they would massively have to cut, because there's no way they could run these deficits, because the American public would now be paying for them all. And if we did, that would just destroy the economy.
And we don't have the savings. Although the savings rate has gone up, we do not have the savings to absorb all those treasuries. There's just no way. And
right, because we got the savings from the federal government, which is hilarious.
exactly. Okay, so I'm totally following what's going on with the DXY. We talked about what's going on with the domestic economy and maybe the Federal Reserve, and if they lost the reserve currency. So that's really kind of the balancing act of the Fed here. So that's kind of the checks and balances, if I'm hearing you right. that would prevent the Fed from just literally buying everything or doing, well, let's talk about that. What do you think about UBI and how would that play into the whole inflation deflation equation?
Yeah, I don't think we'll have UBI because effectively we have it right now. And people think, okay, that's the solution. Well, the problem is unless the Fed can directly monetize the debt, and they can't, then that means the federal government has to borrow more and more money to give to people. Okay, well then the more they borrow, the more they destroy the real economy, because you look at the labor force participation rate and we look at the velocity of money, both are correlate, or not the velocity of money, the inverse of government debt, which are draw the velocity of money down. So you have fewer people that can work, an absolute destruction of the economy, and eventually they can no longer sustain UBI because they don't have the resources to do it. This is where I, and this is interesting, because Brent Johnson and I had kind of a discussion last week about his milkshake theory. And it was rather confusing to me because he has this view, as I'm sure you know, where money is going to flow from foreign accounts into the US stock market. And when I came up with a much simpler view, because his view is there's a lot of moving parts. And I'm like, Brent, I don't get it. But let me explain it to you in Steve Lehman terms, okay? Yeah. Here's what's going to happen. There's going to be a global depression. He goes, yeah. And I said, and we need to get Americans to spend, American consumers to spend money. We know that there's a relationship between spending and stock prices, but the Fed can't buy stocks. Yep, you got it. But what stops the Swiss National Bank or the Bank of Japan or some other central bank who has less restrictive laws from printing money, devaluing their currency against the dollar and buying US equities? Nothing.
Could they do that?
That is actually an interesting solution.
Could they do that through swap lines?
No. Like the Swiss National Bank, literally to keep their currency devalued against the dollar, prints a currency, sells it on the open market for dollars, and then turns around and buys U.S. equities. They're a large holder of a huge holder of U.S. equities. Well, what if several or many foreign central banks did the same thing because their laws about printing money and buying equities are not the same as the Fed? Well, then effectively you could get a resurgence in the U.S. stock market and a strong dollar at the same time. It's an interesting view.
I see. So, okay. So, but then if they're printing their currency, right, they're buying dollars to buy, yeah, to buy equities.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, I see. But then that's going to, okay. So if they're buying the equities from the balance sheet of let's say the American consumer, then that might increase, no, that wouldn't increase M2.
It wouldn't be. Yeah. I mean, well, depend on who they're buying them from. They're buying from the dealers, I guess. No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't happen from the M2.
It wouldn't happen from M2 because they're buying the dollars and then they're spending those dollars. But then wouldn't there be an asset swap with the equities on the asset side of the balance sheet of whom or the, of the seller?
Well, it depends on where they got the dollars from, right? Because dollars aren't just in the U.S. So, I mean, depends on who had them.
Right. There you go.
That's one thing people have to, as a reserve currency, you can't just assume, we're a closed system. I mean,
right.
you being a St. Bart's have dollars. Well, if I could get them from you, well, you're kind of probably tied to the M2 there, but theoretically I could go to another country and get someone who has dollars to give them to me.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. So what can people do to prepare for this? I always say you've got to be prepared or you're going to be a victim. Especially in this world that's so tumultuous and uncertain. What's hard for me about bonds is because I have this motto that I just buy things when they're cheap and sell them when they're expensive, period. You got to start there.
And that's how you make money in real estate, right?
Yeah, you make money on the buy side. So, and there's just absolutely nothing that's cheap right now about bonds. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't triple in price. Who knows? But they're just not cheap right now based on historical standards. So what if this plays out with this slight deflation, then a bump up to inflation, then a continual kind of grind down with this deflationary kind of Japan type setup? I mean, what does the average person do?
Well, the average person should first not put their faith in the Fed propping asset prices up. We've done, okay. People have done that before, and it's a huge mistake. And if you think they can, they can't. And when you're surprised that they can't, you have a lot to lose. Now, is the bond market high in value? Sure, it is. But if you think rates can go to zero and you can understand how you make money by researching what duration is and how when interest rates go down, what that means to your principal value, it doesn't mean you have to hold the bonds. I mean, I'm sure it's the same, you know, when you were, you know, in real estate, George. I mean, if you buy a house or something, it goes way up in value right away. You don't say like, well, I think I'll wait 10 more years. Sometimes you sell some of those things because, hey, it puts cash back in your pocket. Yeah. And that's the same with the bond market, is you can look at it to hedge your risk assets. And the other factor is, if I'm right, those bonds will appreciate in value. Risk assets will depreciate. You sell your bonds and then go and buy risk assets cheap. I mean, or at a cheaper valuation. And then you rinse, repeat. I mean, you don't have to buy and hold.
And a lot of my viewers are really interested in gold, precious metals, Bitcoin. So within the framework of your view, how does that fit in?
Short term, I think precious metals. Now, I'm not an expert on Bitcoin, although if it trades like a risk asset, then I would have the same short term view of it. Okay. And I think we'll learn a lot about Bitcoin during the next recession that we don't have answers to. Yeah. But in the short term, if real yields go up, as I believe they will, then because precious metals and gold are inversely correlated, they will bring them down. Okay. But following that, you should have a nice, you know, perhaps multi-year decline in real yield. And there's your final blow off stage in precious metals and potentially Bitcoin as well.
Hmm. Okay. So so you're saying that you're predicting that we continue to have negative rates, that they drop it negative and they take it far enough negative to where real rates are negative.
And what I think is rates will go down and then they'll pop back up because everyone will perceive 0% will be inflationary. And to some degree, it will. People will go out and borrow money. And then the smart money that's been sitting on bonds since 2016 will take advantage and unload their bonds like they've done in past market declines to buy risk assets. Okay. But once that new money stops flowing, because as interest rates go up, lending demand slows down, then it turns deflationary again. And at that point, you see real yields decline. And that's where you saw that kind of post-Great Financial Crisis, you know, massive rally in gold for those who missed out on the pre-Great Financial Crisis.
Got it. All right, Steve. Well, I appreciate your time. We've gone almost an hour. That flew by, man. I really appreciate the lesson, and I appreciate you expanding my mind and sharing with me and all my viewers and listeners your extensive knowledge and research. So for anyone out there that wants to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
The best places to find me are on my website at stephenvanmeter.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Metra. I say it's pronounced different than spelled, M-E-T-R-E, Stephen. Yeah. And I do a YouTube show 3 days a week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays on macro and what's going on in the economy, the Fed, and the markets.
Yeah, and you use props too. I noticed that on some of your videos. So for people who, I think it's great because for advanced people like Brent, you know, they even get value out of it. But then for maybe a novice, someone who might not have the understanding, they can follow it as well because you're using props to really guide people through the esoteric language and just getting them to understand the concepts so they can make better decisions for themselves.
Yeah, just like your whiteboard. As we talked earlier, when you were reading the Federal Reserve Act, some of the stuff is dry and boring, and you got to make it fun.
Yeah, some of it. some of it. 100% of that thing is completely dry and boring. But all right, Steve, thanks for your time, buddy. I can't wait to do it again.
George, it was a pleasure being on your show, and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.